Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, and this is Disaster Zone, a podcast about emergencies and disasters. Disaster Zone will bring you interviews and commentaries about all aspects of disasters, from what causes them to how people and organizations are dealing with their impact. Merit has the disaster-proven software you need to track people, their credentials, and licenses, along with the hours they work on scene at a disaster. Merit's solution was used extensively by first responders and emergency professionals during the tragic Surfside building collapse. The state of Florida's response to COVID-19 and at health and human service facilities nationwide, and along with thousands of other organizations using this software. For more information, visit www.merits.com/disaster zone. Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, your host, and welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast. With me today is Sean Dahl, a senior weather space forecaster at the Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado. And today, we'll be learning all about weather, not here on Earth, but space weather coming from our sun that can impact many aspects of our modern lives here on Earth. If you don't know anything about the categories of warnings and what the potential impacts are of space weather, you need to keep listening. Welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast, Sean.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. It's great to be here, and I look forward to getting people smarter about space weather and the importance of it.
Yeah, and just before we started, I shared, folks, that I had an opportunity to brief a European country, very small European country, and they had some electrical grid people in part of that group that was touring the United States, and I talked to them about corneal mass ejections and EMP, help me out, Sean. EMP.
EMP is for the nuclear stuff. Geomagnetic induced currents for the.
Yeah. Yes. Electromagnetic pulse. There we go. Dude, I just did a podcast, so I should be able to remember it. Anyway, they hadn't heard of it, so I'm sure there's a lot of people tuning in today that won't have any idea about what we're talking. So we're about to get schooled on this, folks. So Sean, I always like to ask people. The question about it, you know, give our listeners a brief synopsis of your background and career path up until today.
Yeah, of course, Eric. I had an odd path. It wasn't the purely academic route by any stretch. I had a long journey that took me through the Air Force. So I originally started in a college to go for an environmental science degree, and yet here I'm doing physical sciences. I left 2 years early to join the Air Force for what I thought would be just a couple of years stint, kind of a change of pace. Well, 22 years later, I retired from the Air Force, and I spent much of that time in going to schools, training, and pretty much working in the field of meteorology and space weather. So while I was in the Air Force, I continued taking university classes that covered a broad spectrum of physical sciences. And so even though I haven't earned an advanced degree, I've stockpiled a whole lot of college credits to this regard. I retired from the Air Force in 2007, was quickly hired as a lead forecaster, once again, for the Air Force, but as a civilian now, where I was doing worldwide aviation forecasting for 5 years. And space weather, by the way, is important to aviation nowadays. I went to Hawaii because I leaped on an opportunity to join the National Weather Service. I spent 3 years out there. And finally, I was hired here as a space weather forecaster at the Space Weather Prediction Center. And so that's pretty much my quick synopsis career
path. And how long have you been at the Space Weather Prediction Center?
I've been here for 8 years now.
Okay, all right, you're no neophyte then. You're not wet behind the ears there. Okay, and then typically, I don't think of the National Weather Service as being concerned with, or I normally think about them being concerned with storms here on Earth, flooding, tornadoes, hurricanes, atmospheric rivers, and like, when was the Space Prediction Center established?
Yeah, it started Not as the title it is now, but it started as an organization in 1961 that was called the Space Environment Center. However, as its operations grew and space weather became more known to the people that the researchers basically were running the show at the time, it eventually became realigned under the National Weather Service and was renamed the Space Weather Prediction Center, or SWPSC, as we like to call it for short, and I'll probably keep calling it SWPSC from here on out, in 2007. So I've been proud to be part of this center here now for the last 8 years.
Okay, all right. Well, how about give our listeners a bit more information about the Space Weather Prediction Center? Yeah, where is it? What does it do? And I guess I've got a question is, why isn't it called a warning center? Typically, in emergency management world, we'd call it a warning center. So what is it that you guys do, and how come it's not a warning center? Or is it doing more than warning? Is that the deal?
Yeah, okay. Well, so SWPSC, we're the nation's official source for space weather watches, warnings, and alerts. We provide 24 hours, 7 days a week forecast operations staffing, because the sun, even though it follows a cycle of activity that we'll talk about here later, I'm sure, it can do something at any time, even when we're not, when the sun is at the least likely level to produce activity. We're located here in Boulder, Colorado, and provide real-time monitoring and forecasting of space weather events that have the potential to impact our technology, primarily satellites, radio communications, nav systems, the power grid, and more. We explore and evaluate new models and transition them into operations, because this is a very much a growing concern in business these days. And our mission has grown notably in that regard as well. Now we're part, as SWPSC, we're also now part of an international community that does aviation space weather forecasting support. We're one of four international consortiums that do that. And even though we're not called a warning center, Eric, we are called a warning center in the guys that we do for the Space Environment Service international level. We're actually the primary lead warning center for that aspect of our mission. And even though we're not called a warning center in the Weather Service, just like any forecast office, they're not called a warning center. It's really because we do so much more. We're providing forecasts, in some cases climatology, what we call recurrence, other products and services. It's not just this, the warnings, but warnings are still the most critical and important function of what we do and provide.
Okay. How many forecasters are on duty on any one shift?
Normally we have two. When COVID came along, we had to break down into one and figure out a way to do backup operations from home to help. But now we're pretty much getting back into the mold of having two on duty.
Okay. And I've helped establish the Washington State Emergency Management Division. We called it Warning Center Duty Officer, and we started from scratch. And we had to explain to the powers that be that you can't, even if you're 24/7, have three shifts, you need more than three people, because there's people that go on vacation, actually get sick, maybe while someone else is on vacation. So how many staff are there that go into the rotation there?
Yeah, as far as the forecasting staff, we have 12 positions. We're currently at 10. And at that level, we are able to manage the three primary shifts. They're 10-hour shifts, and that's how we go out and handle that.
Okay, all right. So let's get into more of the nitty-gritty here of what are the different types of threats, I'll use that term, that stem from the sun burning off energy.
Yeah, so well, the tremendous dynamic nature of the sun, it's always releasing energy, right? That's how we get heat and light from that giant ball of burning gas 93 million miles away. However, the underlying dynamics, and I can mean that literally, because deeper into the sun, there's instabilities that are created. And this usually results in the development of very strong localized magnetic fields in the sun that become buoyant, meaning they become lighter and they kind of push their way up to the surface of the sun. And this is kind of what ties into most of the major solar storms that we'll be talking about. It's really about magnetic energy and stresses that occur that result in these space weather storms, if you will. And this happens throughout the solar cycle, where we get more intense times where these magnetic fields reveal themselves, and then they release themselves into these types of storms, such as a coronal mass ejection, where we have tons, billions of tons of solar material that are also dragging along a strong, intense magnetic field out from the sun. So if they're directed towards Earth, we actually get connected to a stronger localized magnetic field that's now transited in space, and we're connected with that at the sun. There's more that goes into that, but generally that's what happens. We can have grand escalations of solar X-rays emissions, and this is called the solar flare, or there can be hordes of solar energetic particles that are released from the sun with some of these events, and we call those a solar proton event, and those relate to something called solar radiation storms.
How about that? Yeah, I've always heard the term sunspots. How's that factor in, if at all?
Yeah, the strong localized magnetic fields, when they puncture through the surface of the sun, if they're strong enough, they reveal themselves as these dark circles. They can be symmetrical or asymmetrical, meaning nice and circular or not nice and circular, oddly shaped. But they really result from temperature differences because they're a cooler area, and it has to do with the magnetic energy that's there and now localizes. Just think of it as the heat and light that's coming from deeper inside the sun. It acts like a reverse plug, like a magnetic plug. So that energy kind of goes around it or in between where it can. So you have these darker, cooler sunspots, and they're surrounded by hotter areas.
Okay. Was there at one point where, besides cavemen looking up and say, look, oh, there's something up there. Let's call it the sun. At what point we began to understand what's happening on the sun? Was that 100 years ago, 50 years ago? I mean, when did our great leap forward happen? If there was, maybe it's just very gradual. I don't know.
Our great leap forward was really probably during the space age that started up in the 60s, in particular in the 70s. Up until then, it was more of a, you know, historical footnote interest. There were scientists of the times, way back in history, actually, where they noted sunspots. I mean, you can see, even though you should never look directly at the sun, right? If you see the sun coming up over the horizon or setting, and there's really a smoky atmosphere, and if the sun happens to be littered with sunspots at the time, you can actually see these visibly. I'm not saying to do it, because you should never look at the sun, but I mean, people are people, and you can actually notice these things. How they looked at the sun safely with telescopes like Galileo, he was actually drawing sunspots on the sun and noting them in his observations. We'll talk about another astronomer later who happened to have the perfect timing for drawing a sunspot group and what that meant for our knowledge and leap ahead. But generally, it was the space age, and really started with Skylab. They had some instruments up there that were studying the sun. That's where we really got to know a lot more about the exterior layers of the sun, such as the corona. Yeah.
And so everybody may not be as old as we are, Sean. So explain what the Skylab was in relation maybe to, if we'll call it the space station, right?
Yeah, Skylab, I'm not a NASA guy, but Skylab was under the realm of NASA at the time. It was pretty much after the Apollo missions. And it was like the first effort to put a working astronaut manned crewed space station up there. It was up there for some time. And when they quit being on that platform, that spacecraft, they left. And ironically, Eric, Skylab came down because of space weather activity and what it did to the atmosphere over time.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. The death of it. What was the diagnosis for the death of Skylab? Had to do with the sun. Okay. So how do we physically detect the threats when they occur? And we'll get more into this, but I'm always wondering, you know, how do we detect it?
Yeah, we're able to watch for these events through a planetary network of specialized telescopes that can look at the sun safely and at different wavelengths of light, even in some cases, that allow us to look for solar flares, look for sunspots, look for other features that we call prominences and filaments that are things trapped in a magnetic field in the sun. And we also have a small, you know, bit of space telescopes up there as well, and space observation platforms out there at various orbits. The GOES satellites, that's the ones that NOAA relies on, and us in the Weather Service as meteorology side, that takes the pictures of the clouds that are always showing up on people's TVs when they turn into the evening news. Yeah. That's really all coming from our fleet of GOES satellites, and we have space weather observation platforms on there. Those are just a little over 20,000 miles from Earth in what's called the geosynchronous orbit. And the latest ones that have gone up, they have the ability to take pictures of the sun for us and look at different wavelengths of light, which is incredibly helpful. There's other satellites that are out there, some a million miles from Earth. It's in the perfect position where it's always between the sun and the Earth as we revolve around the sun every 365 days. It's kind of like our space observation platform buoy in space. So it gives us that first heads up of something coming towards Earth, even though now at that point, it's only a million miles away. That's really our warning notice right there for some activity.
Okay. And that's a dedicated satellite for that purpose.
That's correct.
Okay. And as an emergency manager, I always want to know how much warning time do we have when you say, uh-oh, from uh-oh to impact? How long is that?
Yeah, it depends on the activity, actually. And I think we'll get into that deeper here later, but generally, when it comes to solar flares, their effect is immediate. If we see it happening, that means the effect is already on our sunlit side of the planet. So we cannot warn on that. We can predict the probability that a flare was happening and perhaps what intensity it will reach, but we cannot warn on that. So we alert on it once we see it happening, because there's people in the industries out there that want to know when it's happening because it affects things.
Yeah.
Solar radiation storms, the proton events, we can put warnings out for that, but it's very low lead time. It can be minutes to hours, because they can sometimes get here almost at the speed of light. So we see an event, they could be here in as fast as 15, 20 minutes if they're even coming. And then geomagnetic storms, that's where we excel at as far as warning time goes. There we can have anywhere from, in an unexpected event, it can be very short notice, but generally we can be stretching that out into hours notice.
Okay, I'll take hours.
Yeah, most people would.
Well, maybe we'll get into the second half of the show when I get there and talk about, okay, if I got that warning and I have an hour, what should I do, right? As far as that. But right. Each of those types that you've shared there impacts different aspects of our lives. Like even you say aircraft, right? Now I'm going to be flying on Saturday. I'll be interested about what's happened in a transcontinental flight. Be it a radiation threat to our bodies or impacts to our critical infrastructure. What are some of those there? I remember the, this is way back, Three Mile Island. Sometimes it was talked about that from that incident that people would get more radiation from transcontinental flight than they got from Three Mile Island. So we are getting some radiation because we're up there in space. What's the impacts of our bodies on this radiation? If we have one of these big events, the protons, is that frying us, or does it do anything to the individual, or are we worried more about the infrastructure?
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot to take in there and talk about. So first, this is probably a really good time to let your listeners know that there can be lots of misinformation out there in the social media and the press that overblows these space weather storms and expectations or impacts from them. Normally, very little in the way of impacts occur, whether they're to our technologies as interference or degradation or complete loss or physical harm to our bodies. But that is very rare for that to happen. So, you know, you should always go to the trusted authority, the nation's source, and that's us here at SWPC to get the factual, actual information. So to go to your questions there, yeah, radiation is a scary word, right? And we do put out solar radiation storm warnings. So I can only imagine the fright factor that would cause if somebody's favorite weathercaster came on TV and said, and we got a cold front coming through. Oh, I just received the bulletin. The National Weather Service has issued a radiation storm for the entire planet. Wow. Okay. That would be frightening, right? So there's really a lot to soak in here. And that is the fact that we are, as long as we reside on the surface of our planet and function here within our atmosphere, we are completely safe. We have a dual layer protection system. We have our atmospheric filters screening out any of the harmful stuff, for the most part, and we have our strong magnetic field, which acts as a shield, a barrier for some of these harmful particles that cause radiation from actually intruding too far into our atmosphere to such extent where we could be harmed by them. Just, this is not gonna happen. It really comes in through the polar regions, and the stronger the event, the more it can impact. Now, the deeper they get into our atmosphere, That's why the aviation industry is concerned about these, what we call solar proton events, energetic particles streaming from the sun in some cases. And they get concerned because at the strongest energy levels of these, then yeah, there's an increase in radiation exposure. Astronauts in space, even on the space station, they can be exposed a little bit more to radiation, but they're still protected by our magnetic field. When we go back to the moon, and I'll talk about that more later, they're totally exposed out there. Lives will literally be at risk because of solar radiation storms.
Okay, all right. So what you are telling me, my bicycle helmet, I don't need to line the inside of it with tin foil.
So. That's right. You don't have to do anything crazy like that. Just take your flights as normal. Now, I will say there are some studies out there where the amount of radiation exposure that's going to happen to somebody on an aircraft is very minute. If we have a severe radiation storm going on, well, yeah, of course, there may be some exposure and the airlines are trying to figure out how to mitigate that risk. But there are studies that are showing it's really more about harm for pregnant women to fetuses. So that's something that's currently being looked at to see if that's where the concern should be placed, or if it should be just in general for air crews and pilots that are frequently, you know, flying through these polar regions during such an event.
Okay. I had another thought. You know, you talked about having other space weather prediction centers or locations around the globe doing something similar to what you're doing. Are all those in the Northern Hemisphere, or can they be anywhere in the world?
Yeah, they're anywhere in the world. South Africa has a new interest in space weather. Australia has for some time. You know, other countries. And then, of course, there's a lot of Northern Hemisphere countries as well. You know, and our infrastructure, I should ask something about that. You should keep in mind, too, that, you know, if we have a strong coronal mass ejection slam into Earth's magnetic field, you know, it's not like buildings are going to blow apart. That just doesn't happen. It's really about the impact to the smooth flow of our technologies. Like satellites are going to go flying off into space out of control in orbit because a CME hit. Other things will happen that can eventually lead to a problem on a satellite, but that's not the kind of catastrophic impact that we're talking about.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, why don't we take a quick break right now for our message from one of the Disaster Zone sponsors, and we're going to be right back with more information and more details on our topic today of space weather. Stay tuned. You need a solution to the problem of tracking the people and the hours worked during a disaster response. Merit's mobile-enabled software is the solution that will ensure you have the documentation needed for your own staff and mutual aid resources that come to help respond to a disaster. Without documentation, you cannot get a FEMA reimbursement of personnel costs that you are entitled to. Fix the problem now. Visit www.merits.com/disaster zone to get up and running today. And we are back, and we're talking with Sean Dahl at the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center there in Boulder, Colorado. And why don't we get more into the nitty-gritty of this, Sean? I heard you give a briefing recently for the city of Seattle, and that's how I got your name and number and email. That's what happens when you put that at the bottom of all those PowerPoints. You know, somebody might call you.
That's funny.
So for me, and I was just talking to another emergency manager about this, the warning criteria that you've come up with is somewhat technical in nature. And for emergency managers or lay people, is there a more simplistic way to think about various warnings, or do we need to become more scientifically astute to understand what you're telling us about what's happening? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tough balance, right? Because you're right. NOAA is a science-based organization. And therefore, many of our means of our support can be very specific and technical in nature. And it's especially difficult to communicate about these things, and especially in particular space weather, because so many, you know, people know terrestrial weather, right? They know what a tornado is, but they don't necessarily know what a coronal mass ejection is, right? So we have a hard time explaining and finding that right balance. And The federal government, our government recognizes the importance of space weather awareness, and government agencies have begun taking actions on how to deal with solar storms, their impacts to our way of life. This is why the emergency management community we're talking about, including the national level at FEMA, are being asked to consider the possibility of space weather impacts into their, say, hazard risk assessments and planning. And the best and simplest way we have to convey the more consequential space weather storms to our partners, the EM community, for example, and the general public even, is via the NOAA space weather scales. And that scale goes from a 1 to a 5, just like the hurricane scale, but it's divided into 3 categories. There's other space weather events, but the 3 main ones that the scale applies to are HF radio blackouts, which equate to solar flares, solar radiation storms, which equate to solar energetic proton events, and then the geomagnetic storm, which equates to the coronal mass ejection, which would be that arrival of plasma, particularly that strong magnetic field, and it basically connects us to the sun. That 1 through 5 scale represent changes from minor up through moderate, strong, severe, and extreme levels. And even those terms that I just mentioned, moderate through extreme, we have to figure out what that means, because somebody may think severe means more because the Weather Service has put out severe thunderstorm warnings for a long time, right? What's extreme mean exactly? So we are in the process of relooking at our NOAA scale, certainly how to better communicate with the public and our core partners, such as whether it be the power grid, the satellite communications industry, or satellite controllers industry, emergency managers. And we're now even, the cool thing here is that National Weather Service has taken a giant leap here. We're now involving social scientists. Our parent center has actually hired one. I just met with her this week about, that's their specialty, how to help make this more relevant and meaningful and communicate that message better to partners, professionals, or the general public.
Now, well, being where you are, you might be familiar with the Natural Hazards Center, which is located there in Boulder. And typically they're dealing with floods, tornadoes, all that, but it's a social science heavy thing trying to translate science and that. So they're a great resource for you from that perspective. I'm thinking it's just, what you have is some high consequence, low frequency events. Right, that's one of the challenges. We're waiting for the big Cascadia earthquake that last happened. We know the exact date in 1700 off the west coast of the United States, Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia, and Northern California. But people say, well, 300 years ago, recurrence interval can be anywhere between 300 to 500 years. I don't need to worry about that type of thing. So while the chances of anything happening could be slim, might be slim, could happen tomorrow, though, what near misses? And I always say that's what you have to look at. Many times there's a lot more near misses than there are actual events. And there, but for the grace of God or whatever, we didn't get walloped with it. So any near misses in, I'll call it more recent times. And then I know one you can talk about is what's called the Carrington event.
Yeah, of course. So there's a lot to, you make an important point here about, you have to match the risk with the reward and the measures and costs that it takes to prevent things, right? And we're talking about a very low frequency, but very dramatic impact if it were to happen. So this is very important. There's a lot to talk about here. So this might be my longest response for you. It's true that an extreme solar storm would be unlikely, even at that level, to have a tremendous or catastrophic impact on our technology or way of life. However, we know that it's possible based on some of the historical events you've alluded to, whether they hit Earth or missed Earth. And our government obviously recognizes that the tremendous impact that a long duration extreme space weather storm could have on our society. Some studies have shown that this could be well into the billions of dollars of loss or problems. And that's why NOAA actually falls under the Department of Commerce, which is fitting for us here at SWPSE, because of the traumatic effect that an extreme space weather storm, such as a G5 using our scale, could have on our national economy. In particular, the concern is about the collapse of a large section of our power grid. That's why there's been a lot of legislation and even bills passed recently that really make this a primary effort of concern now. And, you know, the near misses that we've had or the historical events, there's actually quite a few. I'll talk about the Carrington event at the end here, but one of the more recent ones was in 1989 in Canada. That was not a near miss. That was a direct hit. That was a March freezing temperatures up there in the province of Quebec, Canada. Two-thirds of that province lost power, and this was due to an intense sudden arrival of a geomagnetic storm that was very favorable. It connected well. When I say connected, I mean that the magnetic orientation of Earth, which comes out the South Pole and goes into the North Pole, so it's pointed up northward. Well, it's like two magnets together. If the CME has a magnetic field that's pointed the same direction as Earth, it's like trying to put a negative magnet together. They don't necessarily connect well, and you may not get a huge event happen or problem. But if it's oriented the opposite direction, and these change as the CME passes along, then it connects well. So that's what I mean by a strong favorable connection. And that caused the collapse of that two-thirds of their chunk of the power grid. It almost bled into the northeastern part of our country, but we had a lot of damage to some transformers, especially in New Jersey, but we didn't have a collapse here. So we got lucky. What does that mean? I don't know. How does that equate to the Carrington event they'll talk about here at the end? We don't know either. We're still studying all that. In 2003, there was some a host of coronal mass ejections that came from the sun, many of them impacting Earth. So there was a long duration geomagnetic storm, not long duration at the extreme high levels, but in intensity varied throughout that whole period of time. And that caused a whole host of problems to planet-wide to technology and such.
And what was the duration of that been? Days?
That was over a couple of days. What happened there was a huge batch of several very large, strong, magnetically intense sunspot groups rotated into view. And if people don't know, the sun rotates. It takes about 27 days on average. I say on average because the center of the sun actually rotates in about 25 days at the equator. The poles, it takes closer to 35 days. We call that differential rotation. And that's actually what causes the solar cycle and leads to sunspot formation. And what happened is these rotated into view. One particular group actually materialized right while it was facing Earth. And they immediately it was complex, stressed out, and they immediately started producing lots of flares and activities and coronal mass ejections. So you had all these different CMEs moving through space one after the other, and Earth just kept getting pounded for a lengthy period of time.
You know, I guess I'm just a dodo bird here, almost extinct, but I never thought of the sun as rotating. So, hey, it's rotating.
Yeah, you're not the only one. Many of people don't know that. You know, yeah. Unfortunately for us, it kind of does, right? Because one of the near misses was just recently in July of 2012. And I heard that on one of your previous shows, talking about it a bit. That moved just ahead of Earth's orbit. So it was not a hit by any stretch, but it was determined by its speed and spacecraft that actually measured that may have been very well a Carrington type event that would have occurred here at Earth.
Okay. Well, we said Carrington about four times now. So explain what that is or was.
Yes. So yeah, Carrington event is named after an astronomer, a British astronomer named Richard Carrington. And he was drawing sunspots. We know the exact date. I think the time is even known, but on September 1st of 1859, he actually was making a sunspot drawing of a very complex sunspot group on the sun. And he noticed something very unusual. He noticed, I don't know how he's looking at the sun, probably a white light projection board or something safely, right? But he actually noticed a brighter area show up on the white light picture that he was looking at to draw sunspots. So intense that he actually put it on his drawing. And if you look up online, you can actually find his drawing that shows these two lobes of light. Well, about two things happened here. When that flare happened, there was already some magnetic instruments that were measuring our magnetic field. And I won't get into this at all because it's really not that important. But sometimes when you have a flare happen in the sun, if it's strong enough, there can be immediate responses of the magnetometers that measure our magnetic field, not because of a arrival of a CME by any stretch yet, but just some of the changes happen. So the time that he noted on that matched up with that geomagnetic response. So it was a very intense flare. That's how we know that. And then about 18 hours later, wild things started happening here around our planet. The aurora was seen all the way down to the Caribbean Ocean and other Pacific islands.
Yeah. And you're talking about the aurora borealis.
Yep, the aurora borealis, the northern lights, as we call them here in the northern hemisphere. We're seeing in places we're just not seeing. Telegraph operators. We had telegraph lines, telephone lines or electric power yet. Currents were showing up. Batteries were sparking and starting on fire. There's a documented conversation between two telegraph operators from one territory to another in our country here, where they decided to unplug their batteries from the system to stop it so they wouldn't have a fire start. Well, a current was still on the line. And that's the power of these geomagnetic storms, is induced currents, geomagnetic induced currents, as we call them, that can show up on our systems. So that's why what we refer to as the Carrington event, and that's why the name we use as a comparison site for extreme space weather storms today.
Okay, and you can correct me if I say anything wrong about this. You know, the collection point for these types of storms is long distance, high power transmission lines is where they'll collect that energy, and it sends it down the line, and where it meets up with transformers, it overheats them, melts them, destroys them, or can, and that's the big problem. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's fair. Electricity is always looking for a shortcut, right? That's why we're told as kids never to stick a fork into a light socket, right?
Yes.
You're going to get a heck of a surprise if you do that. That's the way electricity operates. So just talking about America here, the Northeast has a part of our country where a lot of the commerce is developed and handled is actually the one that's most prone to a strong geomagnetic response, that or the northern upper Midwest. And there's two reasons for that. One is our Earth's geomagnetic field kind of dips down into those areas, so there's a better chance for stronger responses. And the other reason is the geology. It's a resistive rock over there. So when you have resistive rock and the natural electric currents that want to flow around our planet, when you have, you know, these magnetic events going on, they look for the shortcuts. What are those shortcuts? Electric lines, pipelines, railroad tracks, things like this. And when we get on these transformer lines, that's where they can speed along and get DC current, direct current, onto an alternating current system. And that is not good. And so volts, and there's kilometers, miles and miles of these transmission lines, right? And the voltage that can develop on those can be quite intensive over time and distance. And there's a lot more that goes into that, a lot more physics and things, and I'm not the expert on that. But that is why the power grid is concerned, right? They don't want this strong direct current for extensive amount of times, because then they start noting a bunch of amps build up, and when they start to get to certain levels, then transformers start to overheat or heat up, and thus the problem. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a brief quick G4 storm. That was the severe level. The aurora was seen pretty far south in this country in some cases.
All right, I was going to ask you about that, because that was, you know, it was forecasted and they saw it, and a lot of people went outside to see it because it's a lot further south than normal. Right?
Yeah, that storm was from a CME arrival. It was actually thought to be mostly a miss here at Earth. And this just goes to show how the science is still tough. I mean, 93 million miles is a long distance to try to forecast something, whether it's going to hit Earth or not. And we thought it was mostly going to miss. I think we had a G1 or G2 forecast out. No, we got hit pretty hard. Sustained G3 periods, which is the strong Landmark scale, and then one quick period of G4. And that showed up on some of the northern upper Midwest power grids. They were seeing some developing amperage, enough to make them go out and have technicians check on their transformers to make sure they weren't suffering any problems. They weren't, of course, but yeah, this is what happens behind the scenes.
Right. So there you go, folks. Even maybe a little bit of a near miss here very recently. Okay, you made me think about when you talk about how the Earth and the upper Midwest and all that, would iron ore in northern Michigan have anything to do with that? Because there are ore deposits up there, or no?
Yeah, that I don't know. I can't answer that one for you.
Okay. All right. Well, we could postulate. Why don't we make something up? Okay. So
that's what emergency managers do, right?
Yeah. Well, no. Okay, folks, we don't do that. We try and be factual based until the facts change.
Yeah.
So, but the other aspect of all this that I think for you to talk about that there are cycles of solar activity that seem to happen on a regular basis every 11 years. So what's that all about, and where are we in that cycle today? And what if you were a forecaster, what might you say we're seeing currently?
Yeah, so the solar cycles results and as a result of that differential rotation I was talking about. So if you think of it this way, if you could make a perfect line between the north and south of the sun, okay, the magnetic field of the sun never looks like that. It's not like Earth's, so it's pretty standard. It changes, and the reason it changes is because of that differential rotation. So just think of if something was rotating faster at the equator of the sun, like a magnetic field line, it gets pulled because it's rotating faster at the equator that pulls. So it kind of stretches out. So just imagine taking a rubber band between your fingers and putting a finger in there and stretching it a little further, a little further, a little further. This happens month after month because the sun is rotating at that different speed. And eventually it's like a NASCAR driver on a racetrack. They may lap each other. So these magnetic fields start to lap each other and really makes this twisted up, discombobulated mess of magnetic field lines in the sun. And that's what drives the solar cycle. And eventually other changes go on. It starts to re-equalize itself. So we have these peaks of activity called solar maximum. And in between solar maximums, we have a solar minimum where the sun is kind of equalized again. And we can go months without sunspots. But solar maximum is where we have the most activity. So about every 11 years, we have a peak in solar activity of solar maximum. That's why it's called the 11-year cycle. The last solar minimum marks the end of a solar cycle. So the solar minimum was determined to be by the professionals about December of 2019. So that marked the end of solar cycle 24. And now we're building our way up towards solar max, climbing up the mountain peak, if you will, for solar cycle 25, which is predicted to be around 2025, the year 2025. And right now we are ahead or on the high side of the margin of error of the forecasted curve, meaning we've been having more activity and more sunspots than anticipated at this point in time.
Earlier in the cycle than we would anticipate.
That's right, more activity. What that means for the solar cycle, we don't know yet. We don't know if we're gonna peak a little early and come back down, if we're gonna be stronger than anticipated, or if it's just the sun does funny things. Sometimes it can go on a neutral streak for quite a while, and then it can re-peak in activity. So that's yet to be figured out, but we definitely are ahead or on the high side of the margin of error right now, meaning the sun has been more active than we'd expected
okay.
this time.
All right. Okay, folks, stand by for news at 11 on what's going on. Well, Sean, most of us don't operate systems that are at risk from solar activity. We're not an electrical utility, although I'm sure there's somebody working in the utility industry that maybe is learning something from this. What should the average person be concerned with? Are there any preparations in a typical local governmental agency or a family could take to be prepared for a CME event?
Yeah, right. Fortunately, as I talked about earlier, our infrastructure is not really directly at risk to be destroyed by the arrival of some dramatic solar storm. It's really about the implications, the non-direct attributions to these things that can happen. And, you know, for everybody listening out there, the general public, really the best, there's really nothing to worry about for you as far as being physically hurt or anything or having a problem. The best preparation that we tell folks with regards to a space weather event would be to think about CMEs and geomagnetic storming, because that's what can knock down power in the worst case scenario. And we're not talking about power to a little town or part of a city or a couple of counties. We're talking about states wide if there's a collapse in our power grid, because it's very interconnected. And so a collapse in one section can potentially lead to a collapse in another section, especially from the transmission lines coming down from Canada that we're actually part of and connected to, kind of a North American grid almost. So the best precautions people can and should take is you should always be prepared for whether you're in an earthquake prone area or a tsunami warning area, a tornado alley, whatever the case is. A lot of people should always be prepared for an extended power outage and such, or the lack of water during a hurricane ravaging islands and you can't even get water to your through your sink anymore. You know, it's to, not because you hear of a CME coming, that's because that's still unlikely to cause that problem, but you showed to be prepared for those types of events, which would be the same preparation we'd expect people to have for an extensive power outage. You know, have batteries on hand, have emergency radios to listen in on, see what the latest news is that's going on, because you can't find it on your TV, you know, or have a little bit of water coming available to you, but for certain types of weather events. Just think of those kinds of things that you would take for an expected or possibility of a power outage.
I would just say, just imagine folks who don't have any electricity, and whatever it is you need. Yeah, it's great. I'm all for electric cars, but you know, you aren't going to be able to pump gas either. But think about all the things that we're relying on in our digital age, and digital means electricity. So be prepared for that. Well, Sean, this has been terrific. Any last thoughts for our audience? What are the big takeaways that you would like them to remember? I guess one is, hey, your physical body is okay. So, you know, I'll throw away my tinfoil hat. But what else?
That's right. You don't have to run for cover because of a CME or solar flares happening, you know, unless you're an astronaut out there, or like I said, the aviation industry considering multiple flights, you know, air crew members in particular, that might be transiting those areas more frequently. Here at SWPSE, we're, you know, it's regular terrestrial weather forecast offices. I did for so long. You're always hearing about, you know, lives saved, because that's the National Weather Service mission, is the protection of lives and property. Tornadoes and people taking cover. We know and see the results on TV, right? We see the news, the destruction of a town. Even more recently, we just had more tornado outbreaks. Our greatest successes are when there's no story of a catastrophic problem. That means that the information is being used by the professionals that control our technologies and operate those systems, maintain our power, and they're able to take measures to keep things controlled. So that's really our greatest success story, is when there's really silence. But, you know, the beautiful side of it and things to take away from folks as well is, while all the emergency managers and professionals are out there dealing with these concerns, I was joking earlier about the EM community, but they're critical, right? They have to think about things like this. They have to plan for the worst case scenarios and be ready. And that's more or less what I was talking about there. So we're working with the EM community to make sure that those that need to know, some may not have a concern and may not need to have a concern. Other parts of the country may have more of a possible risk to worry about when it comes to a geomagnetic storm, for instance. But what people just need to take away is, enjoy the beauty of the show, because we talked about the Northern Lights, the aurora. You know, when you hear about these storms coming, find out the information on our SWPSE website about what's actually going on out there, because you may have a chance to see the aurora in certain parts of the country that you don't get to see. So while you're enjoying this beautiful light show of shimmering curtains of light, just know that we are doing our part to make sure there's no catastrophic problem, and that all the professionals out there are doing the same.
All right, that's a great way to end on, Sean. I just want to say thank you to Sean Dahl for being a guest here on the Disaster Zone podcast.
Very welcome, and thanks for hosting this today. It's been my pleasure to talk with you today and inform people about SWPSE and space weather.
All right. Well, I expect you won't be retiring any soon. I think the sun is going to be around a while longer. So, you know, today's podcast gave us all a brief, really, very brief primer on space weather. There is a link to the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center in the description of this podcast. Check that out. And you can sign up to get warnings at that site. And lastly, a reminder to everyone to be safe. Think about what you can do today to become personally better prepared for the next disaster. If you like this Disaster Zone podcast, please share it with your professional and social media contacts. Thanks for listening. Be safe. And I can tell everyone here from the Pacific Northwest, the sun is shining and it's not raining like it's been for the last 10 days. So we like the sun out here in the Northwest. Take care. Bye-bye. Tune in again soon for more information on all aspects of disasters. You can also check out the Disaster Zone blog at www.disaster-zone.com.